you think of nature writing as fairly romantic and old-fashioned stuff, it's time to revise your view. Editor and writer John Murray calls nature writing one of the most important prose genres at the end of the 20th century. It is one that is informed as much by cultural transformations as by nature itself. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations, and on this edition, editor and writer John Murray talks to us about how folks write about the nature in which they live. John, welcome to Conversations, and thank you.
Well, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Let's do a working definition before we wander off. Given that we're going to spend an entire hour talking about nature writing, give me a capsule rather than kind of book and measure. But okay. Many people think of nature writers as that guy I mentioned in the tweed jacket with a magnifying glass in the 19th century.
Right.
Others may think of Terry Tempest Williams writing about cancer decimating the women in her family. What do you think of when you think of nature writer?
Well, I think of both of those. I think that you've drawn an interesting comparison because I think that Terry's work has evolved out of the former. I think that over time, nature writers have become more personal, have included more of human nature in their discussions of wild nature, and Terry's a good case in point.
Mm-hmm. If we have a couple of other examples, someone like Doug Peacock, transforming and absorbing his experience in Vietnam through grizzly bears, or we have John Barrow South Africa. He went through
Barrow. Okay, you caught me by surprise. The African.
Going through South Africa looking for unicorns, right? These are two.
That was in the 18th century.
Sure. Yeah, and my thought when I look at those two fellows is that nature writing says as much about the being, the human being, looking at the nature as it does about nature itself.
Well, I think the two are inextricably intertwined. Alfred North Whitehead once said in a lecture at Cambridge University that nature is what comes in through the senses. So if you take that as a definition, it really is all-inclusive, it's ubiquitous, it includes human nature subsumed within this larger reality of wild nature.
But we haven't always seen it that way, right?
That's true. The Judeo-Christian view, which you find in Genesis, in the book of Genesis, puts a real abyss between human reality and wild nature. And I think we're in the process of kind of mending, in Western culture, in Western civilization, kind of mending that historic schism.
Mm-hmm. John Murray is our guest today on Conversations, has this stack of books, which I think you can see through at least one of the cameras on our set, indicates he is the editor and writer of 14 books on the general subject nature. There's a most recent one on wolves in North America, one on grizzly bears, another on the nature of the Caribbean. There's one on Africa called Wild Africa, and one on Alaska and the Yukon region. This is Conversations. We're going to look today at nature writing with John Murray. When you look at nature writing, because you have through centuries in these books, you have to, when looking at the writers, look at the effect humankind has had on that nature, which is to say you can't look at Africa without colonialism or without the partition and the like.
Right. Yeah, you see a real change from the pre-colonial view of nature and then the colonial and what we're in now, post-colonial, whether you're talking about the Caribbean or Africa. And I've got a book coming out in 2 months on the Pacific. And you find the same sort of evolution through time, where the first people to see the land can only think of resources and what kind of return can we get on our investment for this exploration, exploratory activity. And then gradually over time, I think, there has been a more enlightened view of nature and an awareness of all the egregious injustices that have been wrought upon nature, particularly in the case of Africa.
Mm-hmm. You use in your introduction to Wild Africa, three centuries of nature writing about Africa, you give an illustration, three different writers, each looking at the gorilla.
Right.
Deshayu is writing in 1850 or so, a fellow named Carl Akeley in 1921, and then George Schaller, who's a name many people in Alaska will be familiar with because of his connections with the university. He writes in the 1950s. Tell me about the different views of the guerrilla, and I think it's a good way of looking at the different views we've had of nature over the centuries.
Okay. The first, Paul Deschaux, was 1856, Carl Akeley, 1921. He was exploring primarily for the American Museum of Natural History in New York. In fact, if you go to the museum today, there is the Carl Akeley Hall of African Mammals, which is named for him. He was the first guy who went into the area that Diane Fossey later explored and unfortunately met a tragic death at the hands of poachers and such. And then George Schaller in 1959. When the first arrived, the only thing that I could read from this, if you'd like.
Sure.
He said that the gorilla was a hideous monster, that's a direct quote, known for its ferocity and malignity. When agitated, the animal had a horrid look, enough to make one fancy him really a spirit of the damned. So you see these very negative views of this actually quite benign and kindred animal. Very, you know, the DNA of the higher primates are over 95%, the same as mine and yours. And with the case of the chimpanzee, I think it's about 97.5%. Mm-hmm. So he says that it is a maxim with a well-trained gorilla hunter to reserve their fire till the very last moment. So you see this kind of male glorification of the dangers involved and so forth. And he says here he had one of the greatest pleasures of his life when he killed a mother gorilla and then captured the baby. So he's completely oblivious to the absurdity of the situation, that in front of an extremely intelligent animal, mm-hmm. he has just killed its mother. And then he takes the orphan gorilla into captivity, and he was later perplexed when the baby gorilla, whom he named Joe, simply curled up and died.
Chain around its neck, right?
Right, chained in his laboratory. Okay, next you have Carl Akeley, who was a little bit better, I guess better in the terms that you and I would use. He says, while Deschaux speaks of the gorillas as among the most powerful and ferocious animals on earth, to the general theory of the ferocity, I have never been a convert. And the more I have seen of wild animals in Africa, the less I have believed in their ferocity. And he goes on to take a specimen. But the difference between Akeley and his predecessor is he takes great care in skinning the animal, preserving the organs, and he's a scientist. He's preserving the organs and formaldehyde and so forth. So you can see that kind of evolution. Also here you see that Carl Akeley brought a number of women into the field. So Africa is no longer the exclusive domain of the male explorer bent on conquest and confronting danger and of course greatly exaggerating, wildly exaggerating everything that he would, you know, encounter in nature. And then of course we finally have George Schaller at the Kibera Meadow, and he sees an old silverback gorilla, and his impression is of dignity and restrained power, of absolute certainty in its majestic appearance. He feels a desire to want to communicate with the gorilla, to reach out and touch it.
Not to shoot it, not to take it apart, not
right.
to...
Right. And so his approach is the one that I think is the very best wildlife biologists embrace today, and that is simply to passively observe the animals, not put radio collars around them, not harass them, and in fact alter their behavior through your presence and what you're doing. But what Schaller would do is simply sit there and watch and follow. And I think that he really influenced a whole generation of biologists like Diane Fossey, who was not a professionally trained biologist, but who was mm-hmm. Worked under Leakey's father and got some training in how to, you know, how to observe and so forth. So.
And that was one of her hallmarks, her idiosyncrasies, is that she just sat and was with the gorillas and observed, right?
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are a number of people working on the primates. Interestingly enough, it seems to me that the primates, it's interesting to observe, as I have with the wolf and the bear in Africa with lions and also with the primates, how genders, there seems to be some gender difference in which is attracted to which animals. With grizzly bears, it's very hard to find women who have done doctoral work or master's work on the species. If you look at the primate, the field is full of women who have worked with the animals. And I don't know why that is, but I find that interesting.
Do you think it's as simple as the gorilla is an aggressive, more testosterone-charged animal?
Gorillas are dangerous. You know,
I meant to say that grizzly bear, but gorillas are too,
grizzly.
Aren't they?
Yeah, gorillas are very dangerous. I think a case has been made in a book that looked at this issue by a woman writer that said that women, because of their maternal experience and a whole lot of other reasons she went into, are better at observing animals. I'm not saying I agree with that. I'm submitting it for the audience's consideration.
Right.
But it's an interesting.
You have a remarkable number of women writers included in
Thanks.
Your anthologies.
Thanks. I've got a book coming out in two months, The Sierra Club, Best Nature Writing of 1994, and I'm very proud of the fact that 50% of the selections are by women. And I alternate male and female, so we get kind of a rhythm and a cadence.
Mm-hmm.
That's never been done before. But I, as you can see, I really believe in inclusiveness in gender and in ethnic background too.
So you sat down and said, not only do I want to include these themes of writing about nature in these different places,
right.
but these voices.
Right, right.
What got you interested in this with the anthologies?
Well, okay, it goes back to I'm the son of a career EPA. Senior manager, and that tells EPA, Environmental Protection Agency.
Manager,
and so
okay.
Dad and I and my brothers would spend a lot of time in nature, and I think that planted the seed in my consciousness. Fathers and mothers can have a lot of influence on children.
Mm-hmm.
And I got started doing field guides. I did 3 hiking guides, and I'd hike all over the place and then write a book, and that got me started.
Mm-hmm. Where did writing come first or nature come first?
I think they both came simultaneously. And I guess my favorite of those early field guides is on the Gila Wilderness, which is in southwestern New Mexico, about 70 miles north of the Mexican border. That is where, when I was a little boy, I was very much intrigued by 2 men, Theodore Roosevelt, who was a great naturalist and a great nature writer, and, you're going to laugh, Geronimo. And I always said when I was a little kid, I'm going to go when I'm an adult to where Geronimo lived. And it was the Gila Wilderness. That's where he was born. And so I eventually hiked about 400 miles of trails there and published a book with the University of New Mexico Press on the Gila. I just fell in love with that area.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a movie, I guess, that's just come out on Geronimo in his life, which
right.
is great.
That's
wonderful.
John Murray, our guest today on Conversations. A little introduction to John beyond what he has just given. He was born in 1954 in Cincinnati, Ohio. In the 70s, his family moved to Colorado, which seemed to be a very important move
really,
for you,
really.
Yeah, put you in touch with more nature. In terms of education, John was educated at the University of Colorado, from which he took his BA in English Literature. That came in 1982. His master's in English was in creative writing. In creative writing, and was from the University of Denver in 1988. John is an assistant professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. In creative writing and English and the teaching of. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations on KUAC. I wonder if we're moving too fast. I want to talk about how science has impacted nature writing. And this may be a good
right.
juncture. We've just talked about how colonial views, pre-colonial views, colonial and post-colonial views have affected nature writing. What did science writing do and the evolution of science do for nature writing?
Well, I think there's a real marriage between the two. And I think many of us nature writers act somewhat as translators between the specialized discourse of scientists and the general public who are eager to learn more about killer whales in Prince William Sound or whatever. And they don't really have access to these highly technical articles and monographs and such. And so myself and many other writers, Rick Bass did a book on wolves, the 9 Mile Wolves. Lopez has done the Arctic Dreams and other books. I think a lot of us work very closely with scientists in trying to bring their work to the general public so the general public is more informed when it comes to political decisions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of this goes back to, or winds up going into the political arena. Should we, for example, in Colorado, should we build the Two Forks Dam on the South Platte, or should we not, in order to protect a small moth, the montane prairie skipper, and the decision was made incredibly during the 80s, which was a Republican administration, to not build this dam because it would destroy the habitat, the only habitat in the world for this moth. Mm-hmm. That's pretty incredible. But that gives an idea of how far we've come as a society, I think.
Can we make a connection? You said in your writing, and I quoted you at the top of the show as saying that nature writing is one of the most important prose genres at this end of the century. Does, what about the impact of nature writing on our thinking? To build the dam, don't build the dam, hunt the wolves, leave the wolves alone, hunt animals for ivory, outlaw importation, exportation of ivory?
Yeah, that's a good example, the ivory one. I think the reason that I did this book, the wolf book and the bear book, is primarily political, because I love these animals so much. Although, as I said before, before we went on the air, I'm not mm-hmm. a sentimentalist. I think that we should remove the wolves from that area so that middle class hunters, you know, have a place where they can go that can't afford to fly up to the Arctic Refuge or down to the Mule Chatna.
That area being?
The Nelchina Basin in okay. the Alaska Range. You know, I support what the Alaska Fish and Game Department is doing there, and I think if you talk to most of the biologists in the world, L. David Meach, who have any kind of credentials in this area, you'll see that they have given it thumbs up too. Mm-hmm. So I don't want the audience to think that I'm a sentimentalist when I say I love the wolf and love the bear, but I do these books to try to inform people so that we can save, you know, safe habitat and do intelligent things. Mm-hmm. So we can have both capitalism and conservation, business and natural beauty. They're not incompatible, I don't think.
So that's the urge that comes from, say, you as a particular nature writer. What about the impact? Is that measurable in any way? I mean, can we
sure.
point to the curtailing of ivory hunting in particular areas as
yeah,
a product?
I think so. There were a lot of books, a lot of publicity, and of course a lot of celebrities, Jimmy Stewart and other people who've been to Africa a lot, you know, went and went on programs like this and said, you know, we've got to stop it. There is some question, I think, as to whether that was an intelligent thing to do or not. Now, mm-hmm. it's a very complicated issue that I couldn't do justice to in a few seconds, but there are countries like Zimbabwe that really could benefit from using the sale of ivory to help their national park system. And again, the two are not incompatible. Mm-hmm. I think using a resource and saving a resource. And right now, it's all in one on one side with the elephant. So.
If we were looking at ivory specifically and a solution to the question of the economy and preservation, the puzzle of a strong economy and mm-hmm. species preserved, would you say the answer would be in raising and herding animals for harvest?
Definitely.
Yeah.
I think the two are not incompatible. And in fact, Richard Leakey, who heads up the natural resources in Kenya, is attempting to reinstitute sport hunting in his country. It's been banned since the 70s. And it really has hurt the Maasai Mara and Amboseli and some of the national parks there. The elephants are totally destroying the habitat.
Uh-huh.
There's no predation, there's nothing on them, and they're kind of fenced in these areas. And an elephant eats a lot, as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. They have a tremendous impact on the environment, so he's trying to reinstitute sport hunting. But in the current political environment, it's rather difficult to do. So even people who love the animals like Leakey are seeing that we've got to do something here, you know.
Mm-hmm. So. Humans and nature are inextricably tied for the rest of our lives together. That's the conclusion here of that sentence, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is John Murray on Conversations. You said a minute ago twice, I'm not a sentimentalist.
Right.
Is that a mistaken opinion of all nature writers?
Well, I think of some. Yeah, they see us as just being kind of rose-colored glasses, nature lovers. And mm-hmm. I think the people who are serious about what they're doing, you mentioned Terry Tempest Williams, Gretel Ehrlich, Lopez, Bass, and others.
All Americans.
And of course there are others I could mention outside of North America. I think all of us take our work pretty seriously, and we certainly don't want to just take an emotional view on an issue, but we want to take an informed position based on empirical facts and the best data. We may make the best decision or the worst decision, but at least we're making an informed one.
Mm-hmm.
And our readers depend on us to learn about these areas and then try to guide them in it.
Speaking, and we're jumping around a little bit here, but speaking about readers. Is the market growing for?
It sure is. It's mm-hmm. huge. There was an article which you probably read in the Miner or the Daily News a few weeks ago on just books in Alaska that are related to nature, fishing or hunting or berry picking or wildflowers or such. And it's astonishing to me to see the audience is there, even in economic hard times, really hungry mm-hmm. for these books. So I encourage my students to go out and write nature essays and write nature books. We need more soldiers in our Green Army, so uh-huh. to speak. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Do you see yourself as a soldier in a Green Army?
Definitely, uh-huh. definitely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What the first of these was The Republic of Rivers. Mm-hmm. It came shortly after you moved to Alaska to take your teaching post at the university.
Right.
Which came first, your arrival in Alaska and or the idea for the book?
Well, I arrived here and I saw the marvelous resources that we had here in the polar Arctic and polar regions collection. And I said, wow, what can I do here? Mm-hmm. It's such a humbling experience to walk in there and see all the stuff that we've got. It's a real rich collection. So that book kind of blossomed from my first winter here, mm-hmm. Spending the long winter nights, you know, down there in the archives working through all this stuff. So that was fun to do.
And was this the match struck? The Republic of Rivers
right.
was the good idea that
yeah.
led to the others?
Yeah, and that book was very successful. And from there, we went to the Caribbean book. That came out in, it was supposed to come out in 91, came out in 92, on the 500th anniversary. You know, this was intentional.
Columbus, yes, right.
right. And uh-huh. then the Africa book, and then I've got the Pacific book coming out in 2 months with Sierra Club.
Had you any idea?
That it was going to grow like that?
Yes.
Not really. But I'm working on the Asia book now, then I'll do South America. So it'll take me through the decade as a research project. And it's a bit of self-education learning about mm-hmm. this genre around the world. So
this, you can deflect this question if you want to. It struck me when I was kind of thumbing through and reading sections and thinking about these three books on Africa, on Alaska, and on the Caribbean, especially the ones on Alaska and the Caribbean, that I wondered if some days of editing and choosing, you just weren't overwhelmed by the kind of emotional impact of what's happened to these countries over the centuries.
Yeah, it can be a fairly depressing experience, particularly in the case of the Caribbean, mm-hmm. where you look at what happened to the indigenous populations, the Amerindians, the Arawaks, and the Caribs, and such that were there. Africa's another case in point, the South Pacific. Is another particularly sad case with all the nuclear testing that the French have done in our country mm-hmm. in that area. It's devastated so many areas. You're going to have radioactive hot spots there for centuries, and it's a sobering experience to see that.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a sense that we must learn from such anthologies something, and if so, what?
Yeah, I suppose that's what I'm trying to get at in doing these books, is trying to educate the public, learn myself, and then share what I've learned with the public so that we can adopt, I guess, a more tolerant view of nature and not be so judgmental, particularly about predators, about grizzlies and wolves or lions or cheetahs or leopards or wherever, you know, whatever continent you're on. There's a lot of prejudice against predators, and I guess that's why I did these two books here.
Right, The Great Bear and Out Among the Wolves. John Murray, our guest on Conversations, just looking at some of the titles, there's a Sierra Club book coming out in mm-hmm. 1994 called The Best Nature Writing of 94, an anthology of nature writers and their writing. In 1994, 1,000 Leagues of Blue, 3 centuries of nature writing from the Pacific, the fourth in the series of 3 centuries of nature writing books.
That comes from Melville, by the way, from Moby Dick.
The title.
In case you're curious. Uh-huh. Yeah, he says that he crossed around, I guess, the southern tip of South America, and of course Melville was actually there in the Pacific. And he said, looking out around him, he saw 1,000 leagues of blue. And I thought, what a wonderful phrase to use as a title for a book on the Pacific. And who better to have lead off the whole collection than Melville, who wrote the book on Moby Dick, the sperm whale.
Absolutely. So. And do we get a Republic of Rivers simply from the incredible number of rivers and waterways?
Right, right. Yeah, geography, has, as we all know, has such a huge influence on on this area, that I saw the rivers as really being determinant mm-hmm. in how we view the land, whether it's the Tanana or the Yukon or the Koyukuk or the Colville or whatever. They're beautiful rivers and beautiful names, and I just thought that would make a nice title. So.
It is a nice title. The Republic Thanks. Of, yes, the Republic of Rivers emerged in 1990 from Oxford University Press. A number of presses are kind of gathering to produce these books. The Sierra Club, as I mentioned, Oxford University Press, Alaska Northwest Publishing gave us Out Among the Wolves and The Great Bear as well. These two books published in 1992, as John has said, and then Out Among the Wolves in 1993. Wild Africa, Three Centuries of Nature Writings from Africa, Oxford University Press, came out in 1993.
Yeah, that was an interesting book to do. It was a real labor of love. I guess it started when I was a kid reading African Game Trails, which Theodore Roosevelt wrote. It's a huge book. It's like 500 pages, and he went over there to gather specimens for the Smithsonian collection, the mm-hmm. National Collection. And I was just very excited about doing that project. And the Caribbean was probably the hardest, because you've got 500 years there from 1492 to 1992. And a lot of the early stuff is pretty boring. Mm. It's written in antiquated English, or it's translated from Spanish. And
it had to be included, why?
Well, to make the book temporally inclusive through all the three time periods, pre-colonial, colonial, post-colonial, I had no choice. And I tried to get interesting stories, funny stories, and I think I found a few. I think it gets more interesting through time, because the people are more like you and me. Mm-hmm. You know, they share some of the same things, railroads and planes and stuff. But 500 years ago, the world was very different.
That's important, too.
I guess that's an understatement.
Yeah.
So.
But that's important, too, for writers, readers, rather, reading in 1993, 94, 95, to understand that 500 years ago, the world that created us was not our world.
Right.
Yeah. This is Conversations with us today, John Murray. He is a writer. He is an editor. He's got lots under his belt for a relatively young man, and lots to come, I have no doubt.
Well, I'll be 40 in January, so I'm not as young.
For a very old man.
I'm getting to be an old guy.
We're talking today on Conversations about nature writing. We talked before we sat down about another piece of reading you might do, and this is on the emergence and the impact of an environmental movement and its impact on
right.
nature writing. To get to it, we can ask John to take a look at a passage from the introduction to The Islands and the Sea. Once again, five centuries of... Well, you know what? That's not accurate, John.
Was it from Africa?
Yeah, it's from the Africa
okay.
book.
Okay, I was
Boy,
looking.
I watched right. you pick that up and...
Oh, it's from this book?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't even know my own books.
Well, but I have sticky tabs, see, so
okay.
it works. To get to this passage and this juncture in the conversation, John will read a short piece, read and interpolate a short piece from Wild Africa, Three Centuries of Nature Writing from Africa.
Okay. British conservationist John McCormick has written, quote, "Of all the conceptual revolutions of the 20th century, few have wrought so universal or so fundamental a change in human values as the environmental revolution. In just a few decades, the assumptions of centuries have been overturned," unquote. I think what we've seen are two radical shifts. First, in the attempt to re-sanctify nature, the movement has sought to reverse the process of secularization, the conquest of a demystified nature that began with the Renaissance. And second, I think with the optimism and exuberance and positive thinking that you find in nature writing, you've seen a reversal of the urban pessimism that really has dominated Western literature since the end of the Romantic Age. So we're kind of picking up where Keats and Shelley and Wordsworth and Coleridge and all these old nature lovers kind of left off. And I think that people, our civilization is ready for that, ready for more getting back to nature and a more positive view of nature, and not seeing it so much as something to be conquered and controlled. And I think the eco-feminist writers have done a lot of good things along those lines.
That's just what I was going to ask you about. You described in this book again in Wild Africa again, Isaac Dinesen as a, mm-hmm. a kind of an early ecofeminist.
Oh, yeah.
Let's get to Isaac Dinesen through a definition. What do you mean by ecofeminism? Because there will be people who have
right.
never heard this word before.
Okay, ecofeminism stipulates that nature, just as kind of a paternalistic male-run culture, which I think everyone agrees is the case demonstrably in our civilization for the past 1,000 years, it's been pretty much run by men, by a paternalistic order. Just as they have subjugated women did not have the vote in this country until, you know, earlier in the century, incredibly enough, they have also subjugated, using many of the same philosophies and practices, nature. So the ecofeminists see the subjugation of nature and the subjugation of women as being very much related. And just as we have adopted a more enlightened view vis-a-vis nature, so have we seen women gaining more of the rights that were traditionally given to men only in our society. And so that's a healthy change, I think, mm-hmm. for us too.
How does Isaac Dinesen, writing in an earlier period, a period actually when Teddy Roosevelt and others kind
right.
of rambunctiously striding across the land were writing and acting on the
right.
environment. How does she reflect this?
Well, I think the one passage that I have in here mm-hmm. where she is talking about the giraffes on the way to Hamburg, and the giraffes are in Mombasa, which is a port on the Indian Ocean. And she very much sympathizes with them in cages, about to go to Hamburg, Germany, to be in a traveling circus. And she says, I hope they die before
yeah.
they get to Germany. A male writer would not say that in that period. They would be very jocular. They would joke about it or something like that. And the way she approaches the issue of hunting is very different from the way men approach the issue of hunting.
She was a hunter.
Right. Yeah. Men would always wildly exaggerate the dangers. They would go after the elephant with the longest tusks, or the rhinoceros with the biggest horn, or whatever. Isaac Dinesen and her very good friend, Dennis Finch Hatton, would primarily go out to hunt either for meat or to kill stock killers. In other words, lions that were molesting the animals of the people that lived around her coffee plantation. So very, very different in her book Out of Africa, you know.
Mm-hmm.
on this issue of hunting. It's quite remarkable to compare her and contrast her with Theodore Roosevelt, Ernest Hemingway, her husband, Blixen, mm-hmm. Count Blixen, and other male writers. There's a profound difference, you know, between the two.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. John Murray with us today on Conversations. You said earlier, and you have written, that the women you've included in these anthologies have partly been included because they're women and because they're writing on the subject, but also because they present a very different view. Is this universally the view we find in Isaac Dinesen in Out of Africa, more closer to the nature
mm-hmm.
they're seeing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why?
Yeah,
what is it about us?
I don't know. As I said earlier, there has been a book written on this subject with respect to why women seem to make better field scientists, better observers, more observant of wild animal behavior and this sort of thing. I guess one of the one thing that the author had said was it was the maternalistic
mm-hmm.
experience that women have that men don't really share, carrying life inside them, so forth.
Mm-hmm.
There may be something to that. As I say, on the primates you find primarily women, Jane Goodall and Diane Fossey and
right.
many other prominent scientists in the field are of the female gender, and that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Talk to me about Edward O. Wilson.
Right.
He's a Harvard professor, born in the 20s, a scientist and a science writer. You take him to be one of the most influential and kind of representative of the highest form of nature writing. Why? What does Wilson do that others may not have?
Well, I admire, first of all, his integrity, his fidelity to the truth. He never presents anything in his book unless he knows it to be verified, you know, as a fact. And his lifelong dedication to field science, working in very difficult situations in New Guinea and in Suriname, primarily with insects. He's an entomologist at the museum there in Cambridge. And thirdly, I suppose, the quality of his writing. Here's a scientist who's also won two Pulitzer Prizes for literature and mm-hmm. general nonfiction. That's pretty incredible. It's hard to find scientists who can wear both hats, so to speak. I think another person who I have a great deal of respect for is Lopez. Barry Lopez. He also brings the integrity, but he also brings that same high craft to the task of writing his books. And he doesn't write much. You know, every 3 or 4 years you'll find a book.
Right.
But you know it's going to be a work of true excellence when it appears.
We will have among our audience, and this is why I raised the question of Wilson, we will have in our audience people who've not done any nature reading at all. Where and how to begin, if you were to give some instructions and advice.
To begin writing or to
reading.
Begin reading?
No, reading.
Well, I would go with one of the basic anthologies. The Norton Anthology of Nature Writing is quite good. It's a huge book. It's like 700 or 800 pages. But that'll give you a good sampler of essays from the 18th century and essays from the 19th, and then essays that are more contemporary. And then I would pick up books. You mentioned Terry Tempest's book, Refuge, An Unnatural History of Person and Place, or Family and Place, I forget. Terry's book would be a superb one to go with. Annie Dillard's A Pilgrim at Tinker Creek. So I would marry up the two. I would have both the anthology and a particular volume.
Okay. A question about region. When I have thought about region prior to running into your books, mm-hmm. mostly I've thought about writers, Southern writers, writers of the Northwest, writers of the East, writers of the West Coasts in my country alone. Now, when I'm thinking about region, I'm thinking as much about the voice of the place, separate from the person writing about it, as I am about the writer. Is this... do you think this, in kind of this time where we're more conscious of the environment, is going to emerge as a separate area within the genre where the place speaks? 300 years of writing about Africa, 500 about the Caribbean.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't looked at it that way, but that's a good way of looking at these particular gatherings. Is it's almost as if the continent is speaking
yeah.
through these many different voices, many different faces, men, women, Native Africans, non-Native Europeans who have gone there, all have been affected by the continent and her wildlife and great scenery, and also the incredible human history over 100,000 years or so mm-hmm. Of our species having evolved there in the area around Olduvai Gorge. And it's really been quite a journey. So I could see more books just from particular states or regions, or you could do a book on the Mississippi and a particular drainage, mm-hmm. that sort of thing, too, mm-hmm. or the Yukon.
Mm-hmm. Is this also a way, and I'm not asking you to blatantly flog your books, but also a way to get into nature reading, is to read through a region someone might be mm-hmm. interested in?
Mm-hmm. It's really a nice journey because you get to see, again, the evolution and how we've grown. How different people, in the case of the gorilla, have been affected by the same animal very differently based on their kind of culture-bound mm-hmm. views. We're all bound within our culture, and mm-hmm. and some people manage to kind of escape that, I think, like Schaller. But for the most part, I think people are trapped with those views.
Good way to check your reality, look at someone else's. Let's turn to wolves. And
okay.
move on to bears a little bit here. Writing a review of, let me see if I can find the quote. Elizabeth Stapler was reviewing for the Christian Science Monitor, and she said if an award for the most maligned predator were presented, the wolf would most likely take it. Why? Why does this animal get constantly maligned?
Well, traditionally, the wolf has had a real conflict with livestock. This goes back to the city of Ur on the Euphrates. It goes back to the very origins of our civilization. And that conflict has made it, I think, particularly subject to persecution. And in no country in the world has the wolf been more reviled and persecuted than in our own over time. Bear in mind that wolves run in the wild in Spain, in Italy, in Israel, in Greece. Some of those I mentioned are Western European countries, but in our own country, wolves that once were found from Cape Cod to Point Reyes are now essentially extinct or extirpated. Lately, however, I think they've been more revered and more protected. So thank goodness we're seeing a change there. But the traditional source of conflict has been livestock, mm-hmm. and their incredible appetite for animals that have had most of their natural instincts and intelligence bred out of them and are very, you know, good sources of protein for mm-hmm. the wolf.
David Rains Wallace cites our Puritan background as a reason we almost instinctively turn away from wolves. What is that, and do you give it credibility?
Oh, most definitely. I think that speaks to the very heart of our civilization, which is a Judeo-Christian heart, and the wolf traditionally was associated during the Middle Ages with the devil and Satan. And even in biblical references, you will find the wolf, the word wolf used in the most pejorative sort of ways. So I think from the beginning, the
wolfish, leering.
Exactly, yeah. Precisely, mm-hmm. precisely. You find those connotations in the Oxford English Dictionary even today. So I think that goes to the heart of the problem. And what we're trying to do, naturalists who are writers or scientists who are writers, is try to let people see that this is an animal just trying to make its living in the world. It has a purpose here. And I guess the saddest case that I can think of with the wolf is the fact that it was extirpated between 1915 and 1935 in Yellowstone National Park, which was formed in 1872 in order to protect wildlife. And yet the National Park Service hired government trappers to go in and uh-huh. and completely eliminate the wolf from the equation. As a result, you've had a huge burgeoning of the elk, which have inflicted great damage on the habitat there. But fortunately, we should be getting wolves in the park in the next 24 months, mm-hmm. I think, mm-hmm. finally.
George Schaller, I think it's George Schaller who writes the lion. He writes about the lion and he says, predators are natural balance makers. And that's what you're indicating. They go in, reduce the number of moose, reduce the number of elk, so that they don't overrun. And they keep a kind of a constant tab on it through their own mechanism of hunger.
Right.
Yes, no?
Well, he's the expert, and I certainly would defer to him and concur with him. I think that wolves have a salutary effect. This is what Adolf Murray found in McKinley National Park in 1939-40-41. Mm-hmm. He studied the dynamics between the relationship of the Canis lupus pambycilius, the subarctic wolf, and Ovis ovis dali, the dall sheep, and found out that the wolf had a salutary effect. That was the word that he used. The wolf kept the sheep populations in equilibrium, kept them to the carrying capacity of the range, and in fact were the sheep's best friend. Why? Because they exerted evolutionary pressure on the herds and improved the quality of the animals, because only those who were, mm-hmm. you know, it's the old Darwinian thing, only those that were the fittest generally would survive to breed successfully. And so that's a good thing too.
That's a cue, right? It's not that the wolves attack the weakest, which is a sentimentalist view. It's that the strongest can outrun, outclimb, outfight.
Right, exactly. And a lot of it's accidental. You know, animals fall, animals drown, things happen. But generally over time, the wolf will exert an evolutionary pressure, just as the lion does on the wildebeest or the zebra or what have you in East Africa or South Africa. So they're very beneficial animals.
Now, what about the situation we have in Alaska today? We have a situation where the government is saying we have to go in and thin these wolves out. Is it not that into the equation has come humans who hunt, and we've changed that balance? And if that's so, how does government or whoever else is going to make these decisions work out the balance between moose and caribou and wolves and hunters?
The basic problem there is that over the past 3 or 4 years, the number of big game hunters in the state of Alaska has declined every year. And this is alarming, the State Fish and Game Department. And we touched on this earlier, the problem is that the really good hunting would be in the Mule Chaton area for caribou, for meat hunters, or up in the Arctic Refuge. And most middle-class people in Anchorage and Fairbanks can't afford to rent a $1,000 plane flight. And so the Game and Fish Department said, wow, in this huge state, let's just take a postage stamp area, 20 by 40 miles, and eliminate about 100, 120 wolves, wait 2 or 3 years, and then let the human hunters take that 20% or that 25% of the herd every year instead of the wolves, until the wolves start coming back in. And there was a lot of peer review with scientists, people like L. David Meach, and everybody signed off on it and said it was okay. The mistake that they made was they violated federal regulations by putting these radio collars on the wolves and then saying that they were going to go in helicopters and fixed wing aircraft and hunt them from the air. That's against the law, against federal law to do that, as most of our audience knows. So now they've gone to the ground hunting, which is not quite as controversial, but nevertheless, you've got a lot of animal rightists who are who take a very, very strong position on this, very intransigent position on it, and think that that's wrong too. In my judgment, it is not. I think that's a reasonable position to take for the state, that we could have this one area where people could go and get their meat, and they're trying to reverse this trend, you know, of hunters not hunting.
Mm-hmm. And this isn't a wholesale slaughter of the wolves.
Yeah, actually, it is.
Oh, in that small area.
Yeah,
yes,
they're going
it is.
Into
All
the
right.
rivers and pretty much both state-hired trappers and then private people that just go in with their snowmobiles or whatever, just going in and pretty much taking, you know, the wolves out. As I say, I guess the thing that's been most persuasive for me is that people who know a lot more about this subject than I ever will, like Meach, have said, what's the big deal? Right. You know, the wolves are not endangered here. They never will be. You've got national parks like Denali the size of Massachusetts. It's an economic issue, really. It's trying to help people that would like to hunt but can't afford, you know, to take these flights.
And that's a valid function as far as you're concerned.
I think so. Yeah. And people are often surprised that someone who's a conservationist, someone who obviously loves the animal so much, could take that. But again, I don't think it's incompatible.
Mm-hmm. John Murray's with us on Conversations. We're taking a look at nature writing, and in this portion of the program specifically, at the world of wolves with John. John's got a number of essays in books which are not his own. Look for an essay on stewardship in the 1993 collection called Sacred Trusts, Essays on Stewardship and Responsibility. Who published that, John? Do you remember?
That was Mercury House in San Francisco.
Okay. Also in 1994, Harper Collins' offering called Spirit and Nature, or another, Vintage Books, 1994. Their anthology is called The Nature Anthology. You'll find portions of John Murray's writing in each. John's writing also appears in each of his books. He has a chapter as well as the preface and the introduction. Sometimes he has a couple of chapters taking a look at the region that is being written about and that he has edited from his own point of view. Other books by John: Wild Hunters, Predators in Peril, Nature's New Voices, which came out in 1992 from Fulcrum, The Gila Wilderness, John referred to early in our hour, came out in 1988 by the University of New Mexico, Wildlife in Peril in 1987, that was a look at the endangered mammals of Colorado. And was this your very first, The Indian Peaks Wilderness by Pruitt?
That was my very first, now out of print. And at the time, it was the most heavily used wilderness area in the U.S. And it's one that I had started going to in 71 when the family moved to Denver, and just fell in love with that area. It's so beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Does love motivate your writing?
Oh, most definitely. Yeah, and I think it does, whether you're looking at Thoreau or Terry Tempest or Annie Dillard. I think it's a passionate love that we have with nature. And nature's a great healer, as you saw in Doug Peacock's book, Grizzly Years, where a young man came back from an experience as a Green Beret medic in Vietnam, very scarred.
Scarified, yeah.
Yeah, and fell in love with grizzlies and found some sort of healing there in his life's dedication to them.
I was going to say he's found a life.
Most
Doug
definitely.
Peacock has, yeah. Let's not leave wolves. I wanted to ask you ever since I started looking at that book, at where you take the level of debate to be about wolves relative to where you think it should be. What are we talking about that's wasting our time? What should we be talking about to fulfill our time in debate and also assist the wolves and the moose and the caribou and the hunters?
Well, I guess it goes back to livestock. That's the single most important issue when you're talking about this species. And I think it's important for the public to know that in the state of Minnesota, there are over 1,000 wolves. And in the northern area in which they live, there are a large number of cattle ranches, and there's a large wool growing business with sheep, and there has been, you know, for over a century. And that in that area, the two peacefully coexist. And less than 0.5% of those farms in any year are affected by wolves. Mm-hmm. That's pretty incredible. So I think if there's one thing that I could tell people about wolves, it's not so much of an issue here in Alaska because we don't have livestock, except like on Kodiak in a few areas. But that's the important thing to know, because traditionally that's been the flashpoint between civilization and this species. And it's important that people understand that wolves would much rather go after sheep and moose and elk and antelope and things like that than, by sheep I mean wild sheep, mm-hmm. than go after domestic animals. And I think that once the wolves are back in Yellowstone, as they are now in Glacier, that people in the surrounding counties, Park County and Wyoming and so forth, will be amazed at how reclusive these animals are and how little they see of them. And they're going to have their hands full just trying to get those 24,000 elk on the northern range down. You know, I mean, that's going to keep the wolves very busy for a decade or so, I would think, getting the elk down to the carrying capacity of that part of the park.
Mm-hmm. And here, what do we need to be thinking about in Alaska? If you had the ear, as you do, of listeners who might be thinking about wolves, how would you ask them to think?
I would say just pretty much leave the wolves alone. Let them do what they do best, which is be marvelously efficient hunters of small game, but primarily big game. That's where they really make their living. Let's make sure that that whenever we become aware, anecdotally or in conversation, of someone who might have illegally killed something, that we report it. That's the biggest problem with wildlife, whether it's a predator or an ungulate, is poaching, unreported incidents. And it's important that you help out the criminal justice system, which is vastly undermanned. And if you hear of bears being illegally killed or wolves or something, by all means anonymously report it and help these people out, because law enforcement, especially in an area like Alaska, is really difficult mm-hmm. for the agencies.
Mm-hmm. Will you
talk about that one?
Yeah, there's a nice passage in Out Among the Wolves that takes a look at the various personalities of the wolf.
These are two different stories. The first occurred July 23rd, 1989. And a pack of 11 or 12 wolves. These guys came from the East Fork, and most of the people listening have been in Denali, so they know where the East Fork is. It's where the big bridge goes, and you've got the Murray Cabin. They went up on Sable Pass, and they attacked a grizzly bear mother and her three yearling cubs. They surrounded the four bears. They isolated two of them and killed the two bears.
Cubs.
Two bear cubs, yeah. And bear technicians and biologists believe that this was done in retaliation for this same bear unit, this family, violating the natal den site, the birth scent, site of the where they keep the cubs of the East Fork pack. It was an amazing event. It was viewed by people, of course, on the shuttle buses, by the patrol rangers from the various cabins, and it was videotaped. And prior to that time, biologists thought that the bear was at the top of the pyramid in Denali. And I think this event, I know this event, kind of changed the view that biologists down there have of the ecosystem, because now they realize that in certain situations, the preeminent carnivore is the wolf, Canis lupus pambycilius, and not the bear, Ursus arctos horribilis. That's a pretty important thing to know. Mm-hmm. And the thinking now is that this probably happens a lot more than we realize. That this probably goes on a lot in the backcountry, and we were just fortunate enough to see this incident. The other incident, John Morgan, I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's all right. Before you go on, is the wolf in that instance, is the pack of wolf in that instance keeping the bear in line, saying, excuse me, you can go where you want to go, but leave my cubs alone?
They're enforcing some pretty basic rules, which is the natal den site is inviolable. Mm-hmm. Nobody, a golden eagle, a red fox, a wolverine, nobody can violate that area. And if you do, you'll pay a heavy price. Mm-hmm. Bear in mind that the most important thing about this, Sue, is that wolves do not hunt in packs in the summertime. This is a winter activity, pack activity. Whenever you see the wolves in the summer, most you'll see is usually two. So the incredible thing about this is that the whole pack got together. 11 or 12 animals, the numbers in dispute. Some people said there were 11, others said there were 12. Mm-hmm. And followed the scent trail of these bears, apparently, and dispatched two of them. So, and the other incident was just a camping incident where a bear came close to the tent of a colleague of mine, John Morgan, in the English department, and was just curious and just looked at him and then ran off. And that shows the other side of wolves, too. Mm-hmm. Very respectful of humans.
You referred to this as an example of both curiosity and shyness. Do you give the wolf both those attributes?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think they're very intelligent. They're not as intelligent as bears. Bears have the largest cranial capacity relative to body size of any meat eater.
Oh.
They have a really large convoluted frontal lobe area. And I think that's because they have to know a lot more in order to survive. They have to know where all the plants are. Bear in mind, 80% of their diet here in the interior is vegetation. Right. They have to be familiar with plant phenology. Plant phenology is what season of the year the plants are edible. So they have to learn all of this and know it, and know how to build a den and when to go in and den. Whereas wolves are just killing machines. They live from one kill to the next. So,
if it runs, I eat it.
Right. So I think bears live in a very different consciousness, a very different state. And I think humans have always recognized that by the fact that our ancestors, Cro-Magnon or even Neanderthal, worshipped in caves. You know, the clan of the cave bear is not fantasy. That really existed. And there was one cave near Erd, Hungary, where there were over 500 bear skulls found. That's incredible.
Yeah.
So I think humankind has long seen an affinity or a similarity between us and bears. If you skin a bear out, the musculature looks like a human being. There's a real similarity there. Mm-hmm. So,
what an interesting hour this has been, John.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. On Conversations Today, look for this man in print and for the results of his editing skills in print. Most enjoyable, this series of books on Alaska, Republic of Rivers, on the Caribbean, the island and the sea, Wild Africa, all three covering centuries of nature writing, coming out, any idea when, John?
March 94.
All right. March 94 is, Susan. Oh, yes.
March 94 will be 1,000 Leagues of Blue, the Pacific book, and the 1994 Best Nature Writing Sierra Club Annual.
Other works that John is working on, a handbook on nature writing.
Okay.
So if you have pen in hand and want some instruction, wait for that one. Also an anthology of nature writing from Asia, which will continue the series. That and books on wolves and books on bears. A lot to look forward to from John Murray, present and future. Thanks again, John.
Thank you, Sue.
Most interesting. This has been Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis, and I hope you join me again next week.